Man, I have a new iPad I want to talk about this week.
The new 2020 iPad Pro.
Yeah, like, not just like I want to talk about it, to, you know, but like I acquired one. It was no secret. What we got here is I had the 12.9 inch 2018 iPad Pro, and you know what I'll say about size is like both sizes are great, and you know if prices were cheaper, like you could justifiably have both sizes and do different things with them. I think that's been clear from the different years of having to pick out which one and how excruciating that decision can be. And then what I did was, because I had the larger one, I was able to sell it for more money than the new one cost to go to the 11 inch size. So I use that in my favor. And like, you know, it's like what appealed about it for me. The main thing is just for 9 to 5 Mac, like the process of like writing stories and covering gaps for the site professionally. I wanted to try out LiDAR. And I did, and now I can comment on it. I mean, I actually even asked Apple first for like a review unit because they will do that sometimes. And you know,
really?
it wasn't you know, like they sent a MacBook Pro one time that I didn't even write about. It was just like, yeah, you know, experienced the second version of this keyboard. You know, it's what you think. And you know, so they will do that, especially for like low key items. Like I think the iPad's in that kind of like low key category where you don't run out of units. But in this case, I mean, they were immediately replied and very polite, and you know, just like, you know, it'll be a few weeks. So I decided I'll just pick one up if I can sell my existing iPad, and so I did. And yeah, it's cool. It's the LiDAR stuff. I was hoping I wouldn't be disappointed in it. Like, you know, you don't want to have to figure out what's the difference here, you know, and is it placebo or not. There are very few app store apps so far that take advantage of it. There's some cool concepts on, like you'll see on Reddit, some apps in progress or some concepts. But you can use, Apple's like sample material on their website where you can preview objects and do that. And, the difference is immediately clear of how AR is used. It's like, on the iPhone currently, if you want to do AR, you need to find a flat surface, you know, a plane surface, and wave your phone around to get a sense of placement, and then kind of focus and then tap where you want it to go. And on the iPad, that whole, like, load in your environment, you know, like a take it in part is gone. Yeah, like
the onboarding preamble setup, basically.
Yeah, which is, you know, like, you've got to have something, some AR content that you care about and that matters to you to even care about that. But once you do, like if you're using it in an application that applies to you, then that step alone is a big deal. It's like the difference. It feels like the old way without LiDAR is like waving your phone around to get a good Wi-Fi signal. And this way is like you've got a reliable signal. Just jump in and use it.
Yeah, I mean, it's 100% true. Like, mm-hmm. If you imagine every other app on your phone and every time you launch it, it'd take you like 5 seconds to get the app ready. You just wouldn't use your phone very much.
And right.
The augmented reality apps were like that because you'd have to, you know, and in dark lighting, sometimes you won't be able to find the flat surface. You'd have to move around. Mm-hmm. So the LiDAR definitely helps with like getting stuff up and running. It's just the, you know, are you actually going to launch the augmented reality apps in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So just for the sake of like trying out LiDAR, that was entertaining enough and informative enough. But then there are some apps, like I covered an app today called Pocket Rocket that just launched on the iPhone. And it's basically like a SpaceX rocket launch tracker. So you can see past SpaceX rocket launches and then upcoming launches. And then they've got really great designed models of all of SpaceX's rockets and spacecrafts. And you can see them just like in the preview view on the phone in 3D or with the AR kit. And, you know, all of a sudden I've got an interest in mind with space and then an application using AR kit where now I'm like, oh, I'm really digging this feature. You know, I was doing this thing where I actually have like a model rocket on my desk and I look at it and I put the same rocket in AR next to it. And, you know, the $4 app is much more detailed and responsive to the environment than, you know, the $140 plastic model rocket. So that was pretty cool. During the beta process of that, they had an iPad version as well because it was like the iPad version or the iPhone version just, you know, set to run on iPad. And they didn't want to release that, and so because they want to like have an actually like designed for iPad version,
You optimize the layout.
Yeah, but I was using it with the iPad, and I believe it was – I never got the experience of find a surface. So I think by automatically targeting, I guess, the latest version of iOS and using the right APIs, like it just accepted that there's LiDAR on the iPad.
Yeah, I can explain that. So if you're using the ARKit framework, which basically every AR app on the App Store is, it can automatically – take advantage of the LiDAR sensing for the room environment and working out the flat planes without requiring a code update. It can just, the framework can just, you know, see you're on newer hardware and adjust accordingly.
Sure.
What the apps have to update for is to integrate the more advanced stuff, like the scene geometry and the big meshes of the rooms and stuff, which is the kind of things you've been seeing prototyped on Twitter. Mm-hmm. That came obviously with the LiDAR scanner, and that requires like new API that you have to like opt into and adapt to. But the basic room scanning on every AR app on the store will be, you know, instantaneous, the same experience you get with like the Measure app that's pre-installed on the new iPad.
Yeah, it's like there's no calibration required. It's just you just start using it. And so I was using the Pocket Rocket app with the iPad in the test light version, not caring about like the layout and everything, but just using the AR part of it. And that was gave me a really good sense of like an actual application I care about of LiDAR and AR on the iPad. And, you know, I didn't touch the iPhone version very much for that reason. And then it went away. I had to clear it, like make sure when it launched, like, am I crazy or was there an iPad version? It's like, yeah, we want to do a proper version in the future. But, and there's a few apps I think that Apple's mentioned in their coverage. Like I think the Apple Arcade game Hot Lava will have an update that uses LiDAR on the iPad.
Yeah, that's cited for later this year.
Yeah, so. And then Sharp or Shaper 3D with no E in Shaper, the C Anatomy 2020 app, and the IKEA Place. I've got those all downloaded just so in the future they'll work. And some different ones too. But you know, I was happy. Like and again, like only justifiable because of my role in like, you know, trying this stuff out and writing about it. But
yeah, like it's fair to say if you. You know, weren't the journalist that you are, you wouldn't upgrade from the 2018 model.
That's right. And I was still
like any normal person would not, because the 2020 iPad's fine, right? You get a small spec bump on the processor, you get, you know, the ultra wide camera, and then you get the LiDAR scanner. That's basically all that's different there. And it's just like a small, you know, 18 month bump up of what was already a very good iPad Pro. And nobody blinks an eyelid when, you know, Apple refreshes the Macs with the CPU bump on a yearly basis. And that's kind of what the iPad will have. Like, the iPhone has boring years too, right? Like you can pick up plenty of iPhone generations that aren't really that different to the one that came from the year before. But, you know, that's just the cycle of evolution. And I think what you see is on smaller devices like the Watch or the iPhone, you tend to get generally bigger steps and advancements just because the fact that like technology exists in the world and it's just always limited by battery efficiency and miniaturization, which means it doesn't come to the phone and the watch quicker, you know, like fast enough. Like the... you know, always on display is on the watch is a great example, right? Like always on display as a technology is something that Apple could do on these bigger products 3 years ago, 5 years ago, if they wanted to, just because they have the battery space to spare, but you can't do it on something as small as a watch until you get, you know, the optimizations in place. And so there are opportunities there for miniaturization to bring bigger advancements to the phone and smaller products. Whereas something like the iPad or the laptop, those kind of changes were already in the product 3 years ago. Like, you know, like Face ID or the scanner stuff. Like, it's those things are less constrained by space when you have, you know, an iPad or bigger device to put them in. So you will get more years where it's just like, here's a slightly better processor, you know, move on with your life.
Yeah. And, you know, I read a piece a few weeks ago that was like the Apple Magic Keyboard for iPad Pro sort of rejuvenates. It puts new life into the 2018 iPad Pro because it's compatible. There's just, you know, more space in the camera cutout than you'd have otherwise. But it makes that product even better 2 years later. And that's still totally true. I just used this in my like cost analysis of deciding, you know, do I want to spend money on for LiDAR testing or not? And, you know, by selling the other iPad Pro at an aggressively low price to cover this iPad Pro, that made it easier. Plus realizing, okay, it's going to be $300 instead of $350 to buy the Magic Keyboard that I know I'm going to want and buy. Plus it will weigh less because it's, you know, it's 2 inches difference. So that was a big thing. It was like, it will be lighter, it will be cheaper, and it will be a bigger difference between my beloved 16-inch MacBook Pro to have, instead of having like a larger laptop style and then a medium laptop style, have a larger and a smaller, and then just more difference there. And so far that's cool. But the weight thing is especially interesting because this past week there's been a lot of, confusion because Apple hasn't released specs for how heavy those cases will be for the iPad Pro. But Amazon seems to have made some sort of, information there, right?
Yeah. So the Amazon listings have been up basically since the Magic Keyboard was announced.
It's, yeah. Like, people kind of like day two.
Clued onto them this week for whatever reason. But there's two parts to it. One part of it is that if you look at Amazon listings in the UK or Germany or basically any country that isn't the US, they cite that the Magic Keyboard is shipping on May 30th. And obviously Apple hasn't released a date beyond May. I wouldn't put any trust in the 30th date whatsoever. It's just kind of like a placeholder. Apple doesn't know probably at this point, and so neither does Amazon, right? Like, they're getting the production going. They'll announce it at some point. And if you actually do want one of these as soon as possible, you know, generally Apple prioritizes its own stores availability beyond any resellers, including Amazon. So if you actually do want one to get one on day one, don't jump at the pre-order button on Amazon. Just wait it out and wait for it to appear.
Yeah, I would not. I would not tie up money in that line. I would definitely do it from Apple directly. Yeah.
The other bit of information that the Amazon US listing does have is it has what it calls the item weight, and that is 2.6 pounds, I believe. Am I making that up? Hopefully not. I'm scrolling now. 2.4 pounds. That's what I meant to say. It says that's the item weight. It also says the shipping weight is 2.4 pounds. Again, I doubt that the item weight is 2.4 pounds because it's very, 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 very heavy. Presumably, the shipping weight's about right because, you know, authorized retailers have to know how big stuff they're selling is, so they have to get ready for their own shipping and delivery and fulfillment lines. Mm-hmm. So if you take 2.4 pounds as being the actual shipping weight, so that includes the box, right, and all the packaging that comes along with it, if you then compare it to, say, like an Apple laptop, about a third of the shipping weight is just the packaging and the paraphernalia that comes with the product. And so if you do the backwards calculations, you get to about 700 grams around that level is what the new Magic Keyboard will weigh for the 12.9-inch one. And for comparison, the 12.9-inch keyboard, the Smart Keyboard Folio, is 430 grams. So close to a doubling in weight, which I think we were expecting, partly because Apple didn't announce the weight figures. And if you just look at the design of the product, you know, you're going to have some heft there to make sure it doesn't topple over or fall over. Mm-hmm. And the counterbalance design.
I think it's actually, I think it's a good thing to be heavier if you want to use it as a notebook in your lap, you know, and have the keyboard not feel like it's going to flip around, like as flimsy as the Smart Keyboard is now.
Yeah, yeah, because the Smart Keyboard Folio is pretty flimsy, and the you know, the clever like counterbalance stand design of this new Magic Keyboard, you know, physics requires that thing to be pretty heavy for it just not to fall over, right? Like, it almost has to be heavier than the iPad, and the iPad's like 650 grams or whatever. So you're essentially doubling the weight of the iPad with this new case, but you are getting a full backlit keyboard, a trackpad, and the cool stand magnets and the USB-C port and all the other, you know, niceties that case provides. So I think for the weight, for the features you get for the way that it is, it's fine. But yeah, if you are used to your current iPad Pro in a Smart Keyboard Folio, your hands are going to have to readjust and your thing will be a bit heavier when you're walking around with it. But I don't think it's a big deal. I don't think it's like a showstopper by any means.
Yeah, we talked about this before, but I just love the idea I love actually doing this, having the iPad with no other accessories, like maybe just the Apple Pencil, if that, and using it as a bare tablet in your hands. And then also like being able to dock it, and then just by like magnetically attaching it to the Magic Keyboard case, then you've got, you know, potentially a charging solution, a stand with like viewing angles that are better than any smart cover or smart cover folio. And you've got the keyboard and you've got a cursor. So it's like without taking this big thing and attaching into it and everything, you know, it could be very cumbersome, but it's not. So that accessory is very exciting. I can't wait for it.
And then the other kind of like little tidbit we saw about the iPad Pro this week was in a security white paper.
Yeah.
It turns out that if you put your new 2020 iPad Pro in an MFI case, and so that's one that has the little magnets in that make sure the screen turns off when you close the case, that will actually trigger a hardware disconnect of the microphone.
Yeah, which is now, very clever. Now that everyone stays home all the time and like the days have lost all meaning, I've found myself working at different hours of the day and like taking breaks throughout the daytime part of the day. And so it was like Friday night, I think. And like I saw the story, I saw the source material, and I was like, oh, that's actually really cool. And I because I have it now, I care about it. It's like, so I wanted to write about it. You know, but yeah, it's very cool. I mean, the other iPad, the 2018 iPad came out, didn't have that feature, but that's when the T2 chip on Mac notebooks added it. So, yes. You know, it was in that same year that they were thinking about it. But then 2 years later, they find a way to bring it to the iPad, which is pretty clever.
Yeah, and obviously on the Mac, you just close the lid and it triggers a little magnet, whereas with the iPad, you have to be in, you know, a supported case. But obviously, all the Apple cases will do it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they could have figured out a way to physically do it if you press the power button, you know, like if or, you know, it just reacts that way without having a case required.
Maybe it probably has like reliability issues because mm-hmm. if you have like a little thing you depress and it, because obviously the power button doesn't stay depressed when you click it.
Yeah, it would have to.
It would have to like, you know, jump into a spot and then come back again. So the amount of mechanics there probably aren't reliable enough for them to like, you know, connect a. Literally, the microphone doesn't work if this breaks at all, and then that, you know, has loads of support costs associated with it. Whereas I'm assuming the way that this implementation does work is the little magnet just permanently raises something, which then makes the wires not connect and
shorts
the circuit and it doesn't work.
And we didn't learn this from like the iFixit teardown, right? Like that, there was no sign of changes there. It's just from Apple's
security
document.
Yeah, I mean, it's
probably
quite a small part that is probably easy overlooked.
But I would love to see like super close footage of this happening inside of the iPad and like see what visibly changes.
It's probably a lot more boring than you think it is.
Yeah.
Like you probably can't even like notice a difference. It would just be like some tiny little wire that moves like a millimeter when there's a magnet near it. That's probably what it is.
That's what I want to see though. I am curious, you know, in the documentation, they say that it worked with Apple MFI certified cases. So, you know, smart keyboard, Folio, smart cover, magic keyboard when that comes out. And then other cases that Apple rates as MFI certified. I was curious though, you know, because I can physically fit my 11-inch iPad Pro in the 11-inch iPad Pro smart keyboard Folio that I had before when I was like flip-flopping sizes. And, you know, the only thing that happens is it obstructs half of the camera. Or it obstructs the LiDAR part of the camera at least. And so it kind of like sticks out. But I wonder if the cases going forward are designed with this magnet in mind, or if it's the process is happening now too with my old case.
Yeah, I think the Folio has the magnet in it to turn the screen off when you shut it, right?
Yeah, it definitely does. Yeah, just a matter of placement.
It probably works.
Yeah. I should ask about that. I'm sure it works, but I'd be curious if it didn't. So it could be like the magnet's like not in the right place or a different place. So. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then the last thing on iPad stuff this week is we were recording on Thursday, but by Friday I plan to publish a quick review of Moshi's iVisor screen protectors. So I've never been like a screen protector person at all. I found them like really gross and not good at all. But I've heard people that I respect talk about Moshi's iVisor. And so I reached out and asked if I could try one out to review. And I got one for the 11-inch iPad Pro and for the 16-inch MacBook Pro. I don't think they have them for the iPhones, or I would try that too. But it's one of those things where like it's got the fake like bezel on the front of it so that you place it exactly where it goes, and it's got cutouts for the right sensors and everything. But it was easy to line up, and I think if you're a matte display person, then this will appeal to you. If you're not like Mayo, you're not a matte display person, then
I'm a screen purist.
Yeah, then you find it disgusting. If you're a matte person for displays, then this is a really good product. And something that I found is that if you're like, it's one thing, and I think like light mode, it's still not perfect where you've got that little bit of rainbowing effect and like bright lighting. But if you use dark mode, it kind of takes me back to like working in retail at Sears, where you had the really old like IBM display with a black like panel and then white text over it or like on it, you know, and it's a matte screen. And that's what dark mode looks like. It looks like you're on one of those kind of displays, and it's just, I don't know. It's definitely like not as nice, like I guess, but it's something about it feels just like less like I'm going to break throwback. Something. Yeah, yeah. It's definitely like a throwback feeling to it. Like I was walking in Lowe's and I saw it and I was like, oh, that's what this reminded me of. It's like that, the display that they're using there from, you know, several decades ago, I guess.
Yeah, like if the screen isn't made matte to begin with, you're never going to get me putting a screen protector on the thing. Like, it's not just the weirdness of what it does to the screen. It's also the feel. Like, I love the feeling of touching the glass of an iPhone and an iPad. And every screen protector I've tried, whether it's the plastic ones or the kind of reinforced glass ones, it just never feels the same. It just doesn't.
And, yeah.
You don't get the smoothness. It's just not quite. It's not quite there. So yeah. It's never going to be for me. But those Moshi ones do seem very good for people that do actually want them.
Yeah. On the iPad, part of the appeal too is that I'm no longer washing it every 6 hours to get fingerprints off. And it feels a little bit more like paper whenever I'm drawing with the pencil, which I really like to do. And then on the iPad, the MacBook, I don't touch the screen. But I would always find where I adjust the angle of the display, fingerprints around the edges, and I don't see those anymore. I still wash the cover off, but not for the reason of there's fingerprints everywhere. So
yeah,
it works. And the MacBook version reminds me of when Apple made matte displays on MacBooks. You know, I mean, I wish they did. I'd purchase that option. Unfortunately, they only do matte in a $1,000 nano texture finish with the already expensive Pro Display XDR. But I've decided that I am definitely. I mean, I was a matte person whenever I went into the Apple store and saw the Pro Display XDR, and I saw the matte one first. And I was like, oh yeah, this is what I like. And I saw the glossy one, and I was like, no. If I were to get one, I would have to go the matte version instead.
We are sponsored this week by Pillow. Getting a good night's sleep is underrated, but with a little help, it can be life changing. Pillow is an all-in-one sleep tracking solution to help you be more aware of your sleep patterns and discover what might be affecting your sleep quality. If you have an Apple Watch, tracking your sleep is as easy as wearing it to bed. Pillow will track and analyze your sleep automatically. One of Pillow's most loved features is the ability to get a detailed heart rate diagram of every sleep session. You can compare your sleep quality with your weight, step count, caffeine consumption, and many other health metrics to discover how they might correlate and affect your sleep patterns. You can enable the recording mode and Pillow will save the sounds that you make during sleep. Sleep talking, sleep apnea, snoring, unexpected noises, all these types of things might be affecting your sleep without you even realizing it. And a lot of Pillow users have been surprised by the results. Pillow is very privacy minded. All your sleep and audio data is encrypted and stored on your device. And when it syncs to iCloud, it's using end-to-end encryption. Pillow doesn't have user accounts, so you can use it anonymously, and it doesn't collect or send your personal data anywhere else. Now, naps can boost your focus, creativity, and overall well-being, and if you're working from home, you can also take naps using Pillow's power map modes. If you need an alarm, Pillow can wake you up using your iPhone, Apple Watch, or iPad. If you have WatchOS 6 on your Apple Watch, the latest updated Pillow uses the new extended runtime API to minimize battery consumption on the watch. Pillow is available on the App Store right now for iPhone, Apple Watch, and iPad. Discover all of Pillow's features at naybox.com/pillow. That's naybox.com/pillow. Sleep well and stay safe. Our thanks to Pillow for their support of Happy Hour.
Let's talk about some more stuff this week. So the next thing up is some new iOS 14 information. This is around wallpapers. The first thing, which is really interesting, is a new way of we already learned about wallpaper sections, but this is a new way of how wallpapers will work with iOS 14. Plus some thinking around how home screen widgets could work in iOS 14 based on some evidence. So what's new there?
Yeah. So obviously Nan from Matt reported before about the fact that the wallpapers are going to be split up into different categories like Earth and Moon and flowers. And what turned up on Twitter this week is actually some images of people running, you know, this internal build, and you can kind of see a look at the new UI of how, at least in the current internal scenes, this is laid out. So you have a pretty major redesign of the wallpaper screen in settings, which is always nice to see. You've got clearly this, when you click a new wallpaper, you have this scrolling list. It reminds me a lot of the Apple Watch Face Gallery view, right? Where you have the categories that go vertically, and then you have the little carousels for each of the different ones in the category scrolling horizontally. clearly, if they are going to support the third-party wallpaper pack stuff that has also, you know, seemed to be in evidence and rumored, they're going to need some sort of expansion of the wallpaper UI to accommodate that. And you can very clearly see here how that would happen. You can imagine a little like edit button, and you just add on the third-party apps you want to show there, and they could just show them in the list alongside the built-in wallpapers. What's potentially even more interesting is that for each of the wallpapers that you can pick, they then have these different like appearance modes, like the home screen appearance options. And so you've got the standard, like, here's the home screen in light mode, here's screen in dark mode, here's the one where you can have it adaptive, so depending on your theme, it shows the light or dark variant of the wallpaper. And then there's a fourth option, which is called a smart gradient. And what that does is it takes like an average of the colors in the scene and makes a background gradient out of it. So you lose most of the detail of the image, but you keep the kind of tones and the color profile, mm-hmm. right? Like the little spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea there is you can have like your actual photograph on the lock screen. And then when you go to the home screen, for text legibility reasons, you can just blur everything out into that, this kind of smart gradient look. So you still get the smooth transition from like a nice picture of your family or whatever on the lock screen. But then when you go to the home screen, all those details can be faded away, but you're not like completely losing the context of your lock screen image.
Yeah. I mean, there are apps that do that, but you've got to know either A, how to use an image editor to do it, or to go out and seek out the apps and then use them, you know, maybe even buy them. So this yeah. makes that integrated in the system, which I think is wonderful.
Yeah. And something that's like something that I really care about, I don't know if any other people notice, is like this little nuance where if you set the same wallpaper as your lock screen and your home screen, so when you on iOS today, when you go in there and you click set both, it will set a different transition for when you unlock, so that you don't get a weird like fade effect.
Yeah,
when you go from the lock screen to the home screen image, whereas if you use a, you know, like a third party thing where you have different images for both sections and the system doesn't know about it, it has to do this like weird transition that doesn't look the most elegant thing in the world. I mean, people make do with it because I see loads of people with different lock screen and home screen images, but it mm-hmm. sets me crazy. And then, but obviously, if Apple's going to build this smart gradient into the system, they can actually then fine tune a custom animation that smoothly transitions from the highly detailed lock screen image to the blurred out gradient. So beyond just, you know, the details at rest, the animation should also be smoother when it's built into the system versus using, you know, one of these third party apps that can do it today. And one of the reasons why you might want a less detailed background is the discovery that it seems like Apple's developing the ability to put widgets, live tiles, whatever you want to call them, on the home screen itself, next to and intermingled with app icons, rather than the current status quo of them being stuck on that kind of like page zero list.
Or under, I guess now it's haptic touch or a long press.
Yes, or when you bring up the context menu thing, yeah. And so if you have a gradient background, that allows you to have a more neutral backdrop for content-rich widgets, right, that might have a lot of text in them or different images and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so you don't want a distracted wallpaper. So those two features definitely synergize. Whether the widgets actually come to fruition and actually ship, we're not sure yet. I think it's about time for them to do some sort of expansion there. Like, when we're hearing all the rumors about iOS 13 is going to have a home screen redesign for the iPad, everyone's getting so excited about widgets. And then they announced iOS 13. And they did like a very small half step in the right direction by letting you show the widgets strip on the first home screen. Only in landscape. And it's still stuck on the left over there, and you can't mix them in, and it's only on the first home page. Mm-hmm. I think there's plenty of scope for them to make the home screen more dynamic. We've already heard about them, you know, working on some kind of alternate list view, which I think some people have taken the wrong way, because some concepts I've seen for the list view, it like completely replaces the home screen grid with this list mode, which I get why people are getting that idea, because it's similar to what the Apple Watch does. The way I imagine the list view on iOS 14 is it's kind of like a replacement for that page zero interface, and maybe there's a button that switched between widgets and today view and just a list of apps, so it's kind of integrated into the Spotlight experience, mm-hmm. right? Not just like a wholesale, you don't want the grid anymore, you just have a list. Like, I don't think that's what's going to happen, but we'll see. But widgets are definitely something where I think it's time for them to make just that grid of apps more, you know, more interactive, more dynamic. And they have like the limits of the system today are, well, the iOS calendar can show the current date and the iOS clock can show the current time. And I'm sure they'd have some limits where you can only have like two widgets per page, or the widgets have to be certain sizes, and they'll make it look nice. And maybe there's some good concepts we have on 95 Mac where it reminds me a lot of what the Windows phone interface used to look like, with all their like live tiles and the little squares flowing around. So you'd have like preset sizes of widgets where you'd have like a 1x4 column and then like a 2x2 block. And in a way, a 2x2 block is kind of like a live icon. It's just, you know, twice as big in both directions. And you could drag those around and the icons would move around it. So I think there's clearly ways that Apple could add widgets to the system without too much like design problems. And I think the modern processors are more than capable to support it. And as we've seen in iPhone 11 series, they definitely have like surplus battery life that people want to use, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And widgets and that kind of dynamicism is something that Android users have been able to take advantage of for a very, very long time. And, you know, Apple always picks from that pie when they're ready to do so.
That's
so
right.
I don't think there's anything like alien about bringing widgets to the main like grid experience.
No, especially on iPad, and then even on iPhone, I can see it. The first discovery we had of this, like my first reaction was, can we find any evidence that this is only on the iPad? Because, you know, I don't want to report that it's going to be on both, and then we learn that it's only on one. And because they did the pinned today view or pinned widgets view on the iPad, I could see them saying, look, widgets on the iPhone are only on the left side of the screen and then within the app when you do haptic touch. You know, but if they do it on the iPhone too, I don't know. I mean, I've got a pretty religious about my home screen setup and it being just two pages, one of the apps I use the most and then one of apps in alphabetical folders by category. So I'm not sure if I would do it there, but definitely on the iPad, like where there's so much more space that's just not doing anything.
Yeah, I think if this feature did ship, you would find at least one application that is useful enough to you that you'd want to put it on like the actual home screen and it can just always update and be visible.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah, probably.
Whether that's your calendar, whether that's the, you know, just even just like a music player, because a lot of what people like about from the widgets on Android is you can put like a little now playing bar on your home screen directly, so you wouldn't have to open Control Center just to start playing your music, or that could be a podcast app or whatever else.
I mean, maybe you could have a whole homepage of just widgets, you know, and it, like the today the dashboard view on CarPlay.
Yeah, or like Control Center, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of, because Control Center is basically like a widget based layout. It's just fixed in place and you can't edit it.
Right.
You could imagine all of those options that sit in Control Center now could be exposed as like system widgets, and then you could have third-party apps make their own as well, and they could just intermingle and lay out next to icons. There is a bit of complexity there about, you know, it's already kind of annoying to rearrange the app icon grid, and you can't even, and all you can do at the moment is literally just put them in a fixed order. So, you know, putting also widgets that are different sizes and stuff is a bit more complicated, but, you know, Apple's clever, they can figure it out.
Yeah.
And like you mentioned about the iPad, mm-hmm. I'm sure that if they did ship this on both the phone and the iPad would support different sizes of what a widget can be versus what the phone can be, obviously because of the difference in, you know, screen size.
Yeah. One thing I wonder about is how buggy do you think this would be? How big of a change is this in such a way that it would make the OS buggy during the beta period, like very buggy, because it's springboard. It's like the, you know, the way that you navigate through apps on your phone. So like, it's not just a buggy app. It's like a buggy everything, a buggy like first page. And then also, is it a big enough change that, you know, they've got to get it right to even put it in the beta version in June? You know, we see it based in December, but it, you know, do you think there's potential that this could be a thing where, it's such a big undertaking that, you know, it was tried and then it's just definitely not even going to ship this year. So to put it aside.
Yeah. It depends the scope of the thing. And it also depends on how long they've been working on it. Right. Like it's not a problem that no one has ever attempted before. And we see plenty of shipping implementations going as far back as like dashboard on the Mac. Right. And that was, you know, that was first introduced in 2005. So
RIP,
the technology is definitely, the technology is definitely like there. If Apple only decided, you know what, we're going to do this in November, which I highly doubt, but imagine that was true for a minute. And then they only start working in November and then they had disruption to engineering from, you know, coronavirus and all that jazz. I could definitely see it just being shelved for another year round. If they've been working it for a longer period of time and it's in a decent state, they'll, you know, they can ship it. I don't think it's anything that's like poses such a big technical challenge for them that it would be out of the question. Obviously, what the evidence that we've seen in the build so far does suggest that it is, you know, relatively early, but we can never quite know whether the build that was actually currently shipping was including all of the stuff that they've been working on stuff. So we don't know for sure, right, exactly what state of existence it's in. The fact that they did put the widgets kind of on the home screen last year at least shows me that they have a willingness to do it.
Sure.
Even if it was just for the iPad only, right? And they decided, you know, it's kind of stupid how we can only put widgets on the first home screen on this very, very corner of the left. What if we just let people drag it around a bit more, right? And just selfishly, I think it would be cool because, like, I ship an app called Daily Dictionary, which has a widget, which shows you the word of the day. But, you know, from everything I can see from my stats, engagement's pretty low because people just forget to swipe to that home screen and see it very often. Mm-hmm. Whereas if people wanted it, they could actually, in this new world, just put it on their home screen directly, maybe instead of the app icon, right? So it would be like the same size or, you know, twice as big as the size, but you actually see the whole word and the definition, and you can click on the widget to open the app if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine that kind of scenario for a calendar app or a messaging app or a photos app. Like, imagine if you could just have like a little like photo slideshow on your actual home screen.
Right.
And you tap it and it opens the photos app. Or you'd have the music playing bar. Or you even have like recent tweets show up or something like that. And yes, people can go overboard. There will be people that use it too much and do crazy stuff. But I think in general, the App Store kind of works itself out in that way. And, you know, as long as they don't make it easy to do, you know, completely wacky rubbish, which, you know, Apple, they won't. In fact, if anything, they'll make it so constrained people will just be asking for more the moment they introduce it. But that will keep it perfect within, like, you know, the Apple aesthetic of iOS. Thanks to our friends at Smile Software for sponsoring Happy Hour this week. Save time typing and boost your productivity with Text Expander. Text Expander helps you manage everything that you type repetitively. Email addresses, phone numbers, common message replies, and more. You just turn the things you type into reusable snippets to access them time and time again. Your snippets can be simple, like a phone number you always need to remember and to write down, or something more complicated like a long form with fill-in fields and automatically calculated dates. Text Expander works everywhere you type, from word processors, email apps, messaging apps, spreadsheets, web apps, just everything. Text Expander goes beyond simple find and replace. You can customize your reusable snippets with fill-in fields and pop-up lists. You can quickly stamp out an invoice with easily editable fields to change only the bits that need to be customized for each individual. If you've ever written something twice, there's a good chance you can work smarter and use a Text Expander snippet instead. It's not just about automating repeat work. Reusing snippets ensures consistency in your messaging. And Text Expander is available on macOS, iPhone, iPad, Windows, and Chrome. And Smile Software is running webinars every month to help you get up to speed and make the most out of Text Expander. There's online tutorials aimed at beginner, advanced, and team levels. Again, unlock your productivity with Text Expander. Listeners to this show can get 20% off their first year subscription. Visit textexpander.com/podcast to learn more and sign up. That's textexpander.com/podcast.
All right, let's talk about Apple Clips. There was a new version of the Apple Clips app, that like the video editing app, but that's not this topic. This topic is about something similar to something that Google did on Android a few years ago. And my pal Matt Birchler tweeted that, you know, he's interested in this. He uses Android off and on to sort of see what it's like. And Google's feature was called App Slices, I believe. Yeah. And from what Matt said, he doesn't have any experience with seeing that actually used in the wild beyond like just the early examples of what could be done.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think it's used very much.
Yeah. So too bad that Slices is already gone, because we can't call these Apple Slices or Apple App Slices. It's just too bad. But they call it Clips because it's part of an app. Describe how it works from what we can see so far.
Yeah. And again, Clips is just the current name. The final Apple changes the brand names to that stuff very late in the game, so sure, it might come out as a different name.
There's still hope for Slices.
Yeah. It would be quite funny if they called it Slices. They probably won't. What this feature is, like the Android App Slices feature, is essentially like a lightweight way for an app to ship a small part of their application that you could open with a link, or you could open by browsing the web, rather than having to like download and install a full app, wait for it to load, click on it, put in your login information, then finally get to the content you're browsing to. And when Google was like previewing this 3 years ago, their like direct demo was like for games. So you could basically click on like an advert for a game and it would immediately launch like one level of the game that you could play about with and act as like a little preview. And then if you wanted to go further, it would then download the full application, or maybe while you're playing the preview level, it downloads the full app in the background. And this Clips feature for iOS sounds very similar. It would, you know, allow a developer to offer some kind of like interactive and dynamic slice of an app, even if the app itself isn't installed. It probably will integrate with the QR code reader. So since iOS 11, you can hold up the camera app to a QR code and it will scan it and show you the link that's behind it, or the phone number, or the action that you want to perform. And with iOS 14, there should be a way for a developer to register with that system. And so if you hovered over a QR code in the wild, it could immediately launch like an app experience directly and almost instantaneously. It's kind of like AMP, but for web, you know, AMP for websites, kind of like that, but for an app.
And not terrible.
Right. And people don't like AMP a lot, but there's, you know, the complaints about AMP are a bit different to what the app experience would be, because AMP kind of like closes down the open web experience, whereas the app slices, the clips, they can just be integrated into the OS because Apple manages the whole stack.
I mean, one application of this that I can think of is like relevant to my use has been, especially on the iPad, I'll use Apple Maps and I'll look at a business listing, and to see more information, you'll need to download the Yelp app. And I don't want to have the Yelp app on my iPad. I don't love the Yelp app that much, but to like tap a photo and see it larger, you know, you need the Yelp app. And so that's the Yelp integration in Apple Maps. And then there's some integration with like OpenTable and things like that, and it's gotten better over the years, but there's definitely like semi-integration that then requires you to have the app installed. And this can be the solution to that and so much more.
Yeah, and it's kind of a way to let, because generally, if you can let a user try something, they're more likely to download the full thing rather than just being presented with a download screen. And, you know, networks are pretty fast these days, but downloading and installing an app still takes time. And those seconds count. If you want engagement, those seconds count. Like, there was a study done years ago now where it's like, if a website takes 8 seconds to load, people are going to, like, more than half of people are going to click away from it before it finishes loading, and then they're going to click on something else instead. And that same rule applies to apps too. If it takes 10 seconds to download an app, the amount of engagement you get on a slice that can download in half a second will be way, way, way higher. And, you know, we've kind of seen some of this, like, with the extension API, but that relies on the app already being downloaded to the system and it just exposing a very small amount of it in a different place in the system, whether it's, like, the share sheet or the widget view. And this can, you can kind of imagine the same kind of thing, but it will be based on, like, a package that's served immediately over the air on the server. So maybe if, like, I think the Maps app opening Yelp's a good example. You can imagine in Twitter, if, like, someone linked to, I'll just use my app, so let's say someone on Twitter linked to Daily Dictionary, I could provide an app slice that is hosted somewhere on the internet, but from a user, it's transparent. So you click on the Daily Dictionary link, and it can open immediately, like, the detail page for that definition of the day. And then maybe in the top right corner, it will say install full application. So kind of what people kind of use mini mobile websites for today. But of course, Apple wants to promote, you know, the native integrated iOS experience and to deliver that as an application rather than having this like kind of proxy website that sits in between.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've seen the feature's been available on Android for a while and it really hasn't got much adoption, but the Android market, a lot of those features never get adoption. That's just reality. Like, Apple has a much more persuasive messaging to people where they can ship a feature to millions of people all at once and actually get developers to respond to it and to implement it, especially in this kind of like augmented reality world. If the slices can like deliver an augmented reality experience, because already you see the things where you have like the USDZ files and you can tap on them from Safari and immediately see them in like in your space. But using your Pocket Rocket example from earlier, mm-hmm. if you were like browsing the Pocket Rocket website and you're like, you know, well, this app kind of looks cool. But you click one button and immediately like actually try out maybe one rocket from the application and, you know, hold it in the room and see the extra stuff that the Pocket Rocket app overlays on top and that kind of, you know, visual audio experience. I think you'd find that the Pocket Rocket app has got a much higher conversion rate on people actually downloading the app from visiting the website if they could be that kind of live preview stuff. And So I think there's scope for it to do it. And we've already heard about stuff like the Gobi app, which we talked about a few weeks ago, which is, you know, the augmented reality app that's in development that's supposedly going to be a stock app on the phone soon, or maybe it'll end up being integrated in the camera. But that's also based around QR codes. So you can see synergies here where, like, you scan a QR code, and then that downloads a slice of a full augmented reality app, so you can actually render the scene right away without having to wait for, you know, a 2 gig app to download. So
yeah.
I think there's potential here. I wouldn't call it, like, groundbreaking. And just from our current outsider's perspective today, something like home screen widgets would have a much higher impact on end users. But, you know, App Slice is a pretty nice feature that will be used in places, right? It'll be used selectively.
Yep. The QR code scanner within the camera app, I'm seeing more and more people know it's there. Just this past week, I left home to donate blood, and I couldn't make an appointment online. It didn't work for me. And so when I went in, they said, "Do you have an appointment?" I said, I do not. I could not make one. And they said, "Okay, take out your phone, open your camera, scan this, and then go to the webpage." I was like, "Okay." And this was, an older person, you know, so, and it wasn't that they were telling everyone who came in to do that, because most people had an appointment. It was just, you know, that was knowledge. So I found that to be impressive. And I've seen more examples of that too. So that's cool. And I imagine, like, with signage and everything, then this, like, if, you know, if it's like a restaurant's app or something, then you can promote that, or like a delivery app that a restaurant supports, then you can have signage that's like, scan this code, get the, you know, get the preview of the app, and then go from there. So
cool. Yeah, like if you put a QR code on the menu in the restaurant and it's like, you hover over the QR code, you immediately see a preview of the full app, and it gives you like a little discount voucher or something. And then top right, it just says install app. And so you can actually get on with your meal while also promoting the application underneath.
Yeah. When I worked in the Apple Store in 2011, there was a very bad period I did not like. That was like, if you're one of the people who are managing either side of the accessory wall, like you're the person who finds someone to check out, you know, there's no registers and they're all lost and confused, not, you know, understandably. And the process was supposed to be when you take their item to purchase, for them to purchase, you say, "Do you know about the Apple Store app?" And then you say, and the idea was you tell them about it, they download it and install it and put in their credit card information. And then, you know, the goal there is you don't need me next time. You can check out yourself for most items that aren't serialized. But it was a long process, and it wasn't a big hit rate for me. It was like, you'd download it, you'd get it like opened up. And then when you get the credit card, it's like, no, I don't have the one I want to do. So never mind. Just let me pay for the old fashioned way. But that's an experience that could maybe benefit from this sort of thing, you know, where you've got just a bare amount with some quick setup, and then there you go. So.
Yeah, or if you had like a video, like imagine you were downloading, you saw like a link to a Hulu show on Twitter, and you wanted to like watch the show. Well, Hulu could provide a slice where you just tap on it. It loads enough of Hulu to actually show the video for 10 minutes. And then you can, you know, download the full app and subscribe from there if you want to. Like, there's a lot of like promotional opportunities and marketing opportunities. Beyond that, I'm not so sure. Maybe the augmented reality scene stuff has legs, but we'll have to wait and see what, you know, Apple's vision for this is.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
To know for real.
All right, let's talk about a new app from developer David Smith, and it is called WatchSmith, which is a really clever name for an Apple Watch app from David Smith that you use to tinker with your watch face. I love that bit. He was my guest on this past episode of my 9 to 5 Mac Watch Time podcast. We spoke for like 90 minutes about basically the app, and which I found to be relieving, because when I got to the point to write the review of the app, I was around 1,000 words and had so much more to say, but luckily it was all in the episode. So you can listen to that podcast episode and learn much more than what I can put in 1,000 words on an article. Basically, like, you know, when I was taking pictures for the app, I was like, this is kind of a hard app to show, because ideally you never see the app WatchSmith, because the goal of the app is to have complications on your watch face that change throughout the day, and ideally complications that you'd already use, but just scheduled throughout the day. And so the app lets you create, you can use a complication for the app WatchSmith, but then program that complication to change anywhere from, you know, like once or twice a day to up to 24 different times throughout the day. You can have one complication per hour. And, you know, it actually works. So there are a few limitations, like, you know, it's not every complication under the sun. It's got to be one that Watchsmith can support on its own. But there's a lot of customization for how you want to style your complication, if you want to use a unique font or the system font, and what the colors look like. So it's very useful. And in my use case, when I was trying to, you know, at first it was like a big learning curve for me, because the iPhone app itself is, once you get it, you get it. But until you realize how the system works, it's kind of overwhelming. It's like there's all these hours around the dial of a watch face and icons and arrows and everything. But once you realize how it works, it's like, okay, so I want to have a complication that's on from midnight to 5 a.m. I put that here. I want to have one from 5 a.m. to 8 a.m. This is that. I want to have a default complication that if I don't have something set up, it goes to that for empty hours. And you can kind of create the dream scenario of, like, I want to see the weather in the morning, my work schedule at work, and then I always work out in the evening, so I want to see my activity rings in the evening before bed, and all that from one complication that changes throughout the day. And you can pull it off with this app. You can't do things like, if I go to the gym, show me, you know, activity rings, things like that, location. It's all based on time. But if you have a routine that is, you know, sort of typical, then you can kind of program it out that way. And, you know, once I got the app, because there was a learning curve, like just from using the iPhone version, it's like, oh, now I get it. I was really blown away. If, like, you know, it's a third party app, you can't do everything that you want to do if it was like a system feature, but it gets you pretty far and it actually works. So, I've got a review on 9to5 Mac. Again, it's hard to like show the app, so you've really got to read into the details. But it even has, you know, one of the questions of what is the complication. One of the big questions is, what does the complication do whenever you launch, you know, you tap it? If it's a complication for, you know, four different apps, what happens when you tap it? And the answer to that is, it's like one super app that's got a bunch of different features inside by category. And so it can be your weather app, it can be your health app. There's even a breathing exercise inside for box breathing. There's even like the Geneva Moon app that is a standalone app from David Smith. It's like basically included in the app, and a calendar. And there's some fun animations with, like, you know, if you change the weather view from hourly to daily, or you move your calendar, it's, you know, don't judge it by the iPhone UI, which is like to build it, judge it by what it can do for you on the Apple Watch. And then also, I think there's a lot of fun and whimsy in the watch app itself.
Yeah, it's cool. And it definitely shows that Apple should probably do this at the system level.
Yeah, yes, yes. I mean, I'm sure we've written like feature requests. We wish Apple would do this for the watch stories before.
Yeah, and it's really not hard to see from the current complication system on the watch to, if you go into the watch app on the iPhone, to have like an advanced configuration screen where you can set different complications to show up in the same slot at different times of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas for Watchsmith, you know, the nature of the beast is that David Smith has to implement every single feature that everyone would ever want into one application just to be able to show the data snippets.
Yeah, and you can't use activity rings. So you can use them, like, you can show them within the Watchsmith app. But years ago, whenever he made Activity++, I was in the test flight beta, and it had activity rings, like, on as part of the, you know, the look of the icon. And or maybe it was even like a version of that, but it still rings. And he wasn't allowed to do that. I don't think he was even – I think the problem was he wasn't allowed to use the rings in the app. At least in Watchsmith, you can, but he had to rely on –
Apple has very, like, precise rules about how the activity rings iconography can be used.
Mm-hmm.
And it can't be used in, like, you know – well, it's kind of an arbitrary rule, right? Like,
yes.
Most of the App Store review guidelines.
Yeah.
But in general, Apple only wants you to show – the activity rings in very select circumstances. It's like, this is the exact data coming from the health app, and any indirection you have to use a third party visualization.
Yeah. And so for Activity++, between like I've submitted it to the App Store to actually being able to release it, he had to go from using, you know, the rings to this bar system that was the same colors, but it wasn't the rings. So that was like as close as he could get without it being not approved. So that's what you get for Watchsmith. If you want to see the activity rings as part of your schedule, for so many of the things, like, that's the only drawback I can think of. For so many of the things, it's like you can present the date in several number of ways. You can present the weather the same way. And by default, you've got things that you can do with like different font styles. So, you know, that's useful. I kind of like just using the built-in stuff because then it looks like just another complication, like the one that you might have replaced with it. And then if you can put like four time-relevant complications in one slot, then the other three, you might open up an opportunity to put more, you know, a different complication there. Like if you don't want to see the sunrise all day long, then you can put it on the Watchsmith complication and then free up that for something else, you know. So I find that to be very cool. There are some limitations that we discussed in the episode of Watch Time of like, you know, I asked basically like, I'm a user, not a developer. Could you do this? This would be a cool feature to have in the app. And it's like things like having multiple Watchsmith complications. So all four of your corners could be, you know, Watchsmith 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then have four different schedules going. And it's like technically, you know, yes, but in actuality, probably not. You know, and some things like that. But it was very helpful to have an interview and then have time with the app to really appreciate it.
Yeah. And like the biggest drawback for me of something like this, whereas versus it being built in, is like when you actually tap on the complication, it's always going to launch Watchsmith, right? And you can't incorporate complications from third parties because it's just right. It's just not how, like, David Smith is pushing the API as far as he can, and you can't just open arbitrary apps and you can't show complication data from other apps. And so that would be the next leap when, you know, hopefully Apple Sherlock's this at some point and, you know, builds it in, is so that you could incorporate a schedule of like the actual messages app with the actual activity app with maybe Fantastical, right?
Yeah.
Rather than whatever calendar experience you get in Watchsmith, whether you get the breathing app and then you get, you know, maybe the daily dictionary complication or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. That's the main step up that would, you know, really bring this to the mainstream versus you having to have like mini apps inside of one big super app that's never going to be quite what you actually want.
Yeah. Right? And but I think that's
incredible technical achievement.
Yeah. I think that's a theme in David Smith's apps, especially for the watch, are that he wouldn't need to make them if Apple just supported, if Apple had already built a feature in. And then the goal.
Yeah, and he's quite open about that, right?
Yeah.
Like making stuff that he wants Apple to build.
Yeah. It's like, I want this to be Sherlock so that I don't have to make it and can move on to the next thing. But until then, like, you know, he's looking at things he wants to do and then he makes an app for that, you know, for it. But yeah, totally. Like if WatchOS 7 had a dynamic complication system, especially if it was like based on time and location, you know, they could do that easily. They could have all four of your complications, or, you know, as many as you have, change on a schedule. Whereas Watchsmith can't do that. So I think that's the goal, is like, yeah, Apple, do this. This is showing you that there's demand for it. And in the meantime, this is the way to do it, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Yep.
And I mean, they already have like automation UI in the home app. It wouldn't be too far of a stretch to kind of copy that thing into like the watch app and just have it for complication slots.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that's Watchsmith. Do listen to the episode I recorded with the wrong microphone, which will be apparent. And some people were like, well, if you've got the 16-inch MacBook Pro, it has studio mics on it. That's no problem, right? And well, a couple of things there. I was talking into the right microphone, but recording with the one in the opposite direction. In a room that is, you know, can be echoey. So it was not the ideal scenario for that. And then after like a few minutes, the fans kicked on. And I had to like read a manual on an audio editing app I have to learn how to like sample the fan noise and then remove it throughout the track, or else it was just going to be garbage and not releasable. But yeah, check out the episode and definitely check out the article. I think they're both pretty good looks at what the app does. Next up, Mayo, you want to talk about Queeby. And I will let you, because I don't know about Queeby.
Yeah, very briefly, right? So in this whole age of the streaming wars, you've got the big guns. You've got Netflix. You've got Hulu. You've got Amazon. You've got Disney Plus. You've got Apple on, you know, a solid footing, but they've got a ways to go. There's this upstart VC-backed company called Quibi, which has raised about $2 billion to date. And they've got some pretty big names on the kind of like headstone. They have people from Game of Thrones. They have Liam Hemsworth. They have Chrissy Teigen. They have Chance the Rapper. Basically, Quibi's done what all these streaming services are doing and given these celebrities a lot of money to make content exclusively for them. The thing about Quibi is that it's a standalone app, whereas all these other major services, apart from like Netflix, have alternate businesses And like the TV stuff's kind of an offshoot, right? It's kind of not the core focus, but they want to grow into new areas. Quibi is straight up, this is all they have. They have to make money directly. And so their gimmick is that, or their kind of twist on the streaming service world is that their videos are only up to a maximum of 10 minutes long. So each episode is a maximum of 10 minutes. And they have this kind of gimmick where you can rotate to landscape and or portrait, and you can technically get different video feeds depending on whether you're in portrait or landscape. And the idea is premium video content that you can watch like while you're waiting for the bus, or you're in a coffee shop, or you just need something to do for 10 minutes. And more than like competing with, you know, the likes of Netflix or Apple TV Plus, it's more like they can compete against YouTube, right? So rather than going to YouTube for a 10-minute distraction, you'd open the Quibi app instead. And Quibi, the name stands for quick bites. So you get quick bites every single day. And their kind of programming schedule is they have about 50 shows at launch, and they release an episode every single day. So every day you get like a 10-minute bite of an episode. And they have like, I'd say they have about 5 dramas of like high profile dramas, right? With, you know, pretty good production value. But the length of the overall show is only about a dozen episodes. That's basically like the equivalent of like a 2-hour movie, but you get them in like 10 minute chunks day by day. And then the other like 85% of their catalog is this random like reality TV stuff. I made a joke on Twitter that Quibi is like what you'd get if you had a streaming service where every show was made by the producers of Planet the Apps. Because it really kind of does feel like that. They have some weird concepts on there. Like they have a show which is about home renovation, but all the homes they renovate are from serial killers' houses. It is odd, right? Personally, I don't really think they stand a chance in the scheme of things. I don't think their content's good enough to battle with the big guys. The 10-minute thing is kind of wacky. I'm like, most of their other content that isn't those high-profile dramas, it's like, I just feel like this stuff would be on YouTube anyway, and why am I paying for it? And then the high-profile dramas, you know, I'd rather see on a big TV screen as like a 2-hour movie than these weird like 10-minute bites. And I don't think short form content on its own can survive as a standalone service. Like maybe if one of the bigger streaming services had these shorts as like a subsection of their overall service, you could see them, you know, getting some traction. But, you know, they're trying, but I don't think they're going to get there. What I do want to say is their app is really nicely made, and it puts the Apple TV app to complete shame. Like, it's so much easier to use the Quibi app to find stuff that's in their library. It's nicely animated. It's very smooth. It's very fast. Like, you just scroll around. And that was kind of my experience with using Quibi last week. I was like, you know, I'm not actually going to watch any content, but man, Apple's app is just so bad. Like, Quibi, you can scroll around, you can see shows. Even though I wasn't actually watching anything, basically, it was nice. It was a nice experience to navigate around and see what was on offer. When you're in the Apple TV app, it's like you're on like a clinical website made by a government wanting to submit a form. Like there's just loading screens everywhere. Everything's clunky and kind of wacky. Like, I really hope that as part of the iOS 14 watchOS cycle, tvOS 14 cycle, that they do have like bigger updates for the TV app plan, because they've made very, 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 very small steps in the 5 months since the TV app came out. Since TV Plus came out, and I think it's pretty evident that they are lacking very much in the quality of the app, especially as this tiny VC-funded upstart can make a way better experience with way less money and resources than what Apple has. But for Quibi itself, I'm not sold on the premise, and their pricing model is kind of going to alienate them in the market, I think. So right now you can get a 3-month free trial, but generally you're only going to get like a 2-week free trial. And then the pricing model is it's $4.99 a month, but for $4.99 a month, you still get ads. So it's a $4.99 tier with ads, and that basically means that for every 10-minute video you watch, you get like a 30-second ad at the start, which doesn't sound great. And if you want no ads at all, you have to pay $7.99 a month. And when you're at $7.99 a month, you're then battling as a service that's more expensive than Apple TV Plus, Disney Plus, approaching Netflix pricing, right? Like, I don't think they can really catch on with that kind of pricing. If it was like free with ads and then, you know, like $3.99 a month or something, then maybe I'd give it a bit more confidence. But as it stands, I don't really think they have a shot. And it's not really their fault, right? Like all these other streaming services that, you know, they're all in debt. And they're all just running loss leader businesses because they can, because they're all these like massive tech companies that have loads of money from other businesses. And then, you know, Netflix is the market leader and they get, you know, funding and they're in, but they're in debt too. Like this upstart company, they're only going to be able to survive for like a year before they actually have to make profit, right? So the fact that their pricing's higher is kind of unfair because all these other companies are subsidizing their TV businesses. But from a customer's perspective, I don't think Quibi is going to get off the ground.
They just need to stay afloat long enough to get acquired.
Yeah, honestly, for one thing, in the run-up to the Quibi launch, one thought that would cross my mind is maybe Apple could acquire them because they do kind of have like the star power, right, in some of these shows. They have pretty big names attached to them. I can't imagine how much money they spent on getting these people to come and do this stuff, but the content is just not good enough for like the Apple, for the brand that Apple TV Plus is trying to make for itself as like the new HBO, basically. Mm-hmm. The stuff on Quibi is not good enough to really add to the library. Like, it feels like Planet of the Apps or Carpool Karaoke level of content, right? And it's not, you know, Planet of the Apps and Carpool Karaoke, they're not the worst shows that ever existed. It's not like trash tier, right? Like, it was fun to watch and enjoyable, and Carpool Karaoke has been renewed for season over season over season. But if you look at where Apple's showing that, they're showing that for free on Apple Music. They're not, even the latest series of Carpool Karaoke, they're not trying to brand it as TV Plus content because I think they just know that it's not high quality enough for what they want. And basically all the Quibi stuff feels either like Couple Karaoke or lesser. And I don't think people are going to want to pay for that.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then some stuff with HBO, Disney, and Apple TV.
Yeah. So finally, just to round off like a little Apple TV segment, we have news this week that HBO Now and HBO Go are being discontinued on the third generation Apple TV at the end of April. We've also seen problems this week with YouTube content not loading on the third generation Apple TV. It's not yet clear if YouTube's like ending support for the third generation Apple TV or if it's just like a bug and they just can't be bothered to fix it.
And that's the box that got the TV app, right? Got a software.
Correct.
Update.
Yeah. So technically both the second gen and the third gen Apple TVs are not getting HBO experience at the end of the month. But the second gen doesn't get the TV app. The third gen did get updated with the Apple TV app. But you know, the Apple TV, third generation Apple TV and older, they're like 8 years old now. They were first introduced in 2012, right? So that's 8 years of an Apple TV box. So it's quite old hardware. Unfortunately, people don't upgrade their set-top boxes very often. And there are quite a lot of, there are like millions of Apple TV, third generation Apple TV boxes still in use. But I think the writing's on the wall, right? Like, it hasn't got like a meaningful feature update outside of adding the TV app for, you know, forever. Apple's clearly moving on to the tvOS basis and foundation with Apple TV HD, Apple TV 4K, and we're expecting another Apple TV to join the lineup later this year. Disney Plus is a major streaming service that will never arrive on the old Apple TV because it doesn't have an open to all app store. It's only those channels that Apple added manually, and they're not adding any more. The issue is the people that bought third generation Apple TVs, they bought them for $99 or cheaper. For a while, Apple was selling the Apple TV third gen for $69 before they then ramped up to the pricing model of the modern Apple TVs, which start at $150 and up. And it's kind of leaving these people stranded. So all these people with second gen and third generation Apple TVs, they don't really have a place to go right now in the Apple ecosystem because like it feels kind of insane that you then spend three times the price to upgrade your box.
Right? Yeah, and having HBO, like, that was a big deal. It was an on stage at an Apple event announcement.
Yep. Yeah, it was. It was like Apple, they did that interview. They had the interview with Richard Pepler in 2015 or whatever. And obviously now full circle, Richard Pepler is now essentially working for Apple to make shows. But that was a huge deal for Apple at the time, getting HBO Now launched. And it's just come to the point where they've given it 5 years of support and now they're going to retire support for the third gen Apple TV. It's very, you know, it's I feel for the people in this situation using those boxes that otherwise work fine for what they want, right? But you can kind of see that These devices are essentially deprecated now, right? They don't get the latest features. YouTube doesn't care about them. Disney Plus is unavailable. The TV app experience on there is nowhere near as good as the modern Apple TV tvOS-based system. Like, if you've got one of these older boxes, you probably need to buy something new. But the sad thing is Apple doesn't really have a great option for you right now. And the vast majority of people are going to just buy Fire Sticks or Rokus because they're way cheaper and they basically do the same things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to be clear, I mean, the reason that they did a software update for the TV app is so they can have, you know, a larger pool of potential subscribers or people in the free trial period.
Yeah, for TV Plus, right?
Yeah, for TV Plus, because like it didn't have that update until TV Plus, I think, right? Like, it was timed for TV Plus.
I think that's right.
Yeah, because the TV app is like old now. I mean, I kind of like think about things in terms of like where I lived when things came out, and it was before I bought a house, and I lived on like 1 year leases at like three different places before that. So it's been years since the TV app.
The TV app came out alongside the 16-inch MacBook Pro, so that was 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got Apple TV channels in May of last year, mm-hmm. which is probably when the third gen got updated with the TV app.
Yeah,
Apple TV channels, and then obviously TV Plus launched in November. The one slight workaround you can do if you have the third gen Apple TV is subscribe to HBO through Apple TV channels, which will keep working.
Okay, yeah.
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 You know, there are limitations there, obviously, because then you're subscribing through Apple. You don't stuff that gets added to the HBO channel takes longer necessarily than the actual HBO Now.
I've got HBO through my cell phone provider, and so that wouldn't work. Like
Either, right? If you have Android devices, you're kind of out of luck if you're subscribing through Apple TV channels. But if you are in, you know, a certain subset of the market might be able to get away with that. But the writing's on the wall, right? Like, these old gen boxes, they're just not very good, and it's really on Apple's hands that they don't have a clear upgrade path for those customers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because the minimum you're going to spend is $149, and that's for an Apple TV box that doesn't support 4K, which is ridiculous in the modern world. But realistically, we're not going to see pricing changes to the hardware until this new model comes out. And so, and the current rumors don't point to that new model coming out until like the fall time period. So there's a several month gap where
and not being low end,
the awkward situation,
and not being low end,
and it might not necessarily even be addressing the low end market. We just don't know.
Yeah, yeah. You'd have to have the 1080p, the one that they call Apple TV 4 now. That's not in 4K to just move down the line, which they didn't bother doing that when they introduced the 4K one, right? They just added.
Yeah, the Apple TV 4th gen has always been $149, and then the 2 years after, when they introduced the 4K one, they were like, let's just start that at $179, which is really sad. But so that's kind of the situation. Like, I'm kind of just annoyed at Apple for not having a better option for people that like Apple TVs, but, you know, don't want to get completely swindled out of their money in the current environment.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. All right. That is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ApolloZach and read my space news and history writing at spaceexplore.com. Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZAMayo.
And you blog at
BZAMayo.com.
That's so nice. And if you have any feedback for the show, you can tweet at us, you can DM us, you can email us at happyhour@n5mac.com. And we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.